Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome to Episode 3 for the week of May 4th, 2025. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer. May the 4th be with you. Let's take a look at the astro events calendar for this week. Looking at space weather from spaceweather.com, there's a large sunspot visible now that has the potential for M-class flares over the next few days. It's worth keeping an eye on. Although we are experiencing strong solar wind at this time, the chance for aurora over the next 48 hours is forecast to be only 10% at mid-latitudes and 25% at high latitudes. Tonight, Sunday, May 4th, is the first quarter moon. The first quarter moon will set around 2:45 Monday morning. The Eta Aquarii meteor shower should be at its peak in the hour or so before dawn on Monday. This tends to be the best meteor shower of the year for the Southern Hemisphere observers, where the constellation Aquarius is overhead. But for those of us living in the Northern Hemisphere, we have to look low on the southern horizon. Above about 40 degrees latitude, the Eta Aquarids are pretty difficult to see. You may be able to see the meteor shower again just before dawn on Tuesday the 6th as well. Those are the main events for the week. Let's take a look at some astro news. Experts call for immediate action on space debris. Experts at a recent European Space Debris Conference in Bonn, Germany, urgently called for immediate action to address the growing problem of space debris. Josef Aschbacher, Director General of the European Space Agency, emphasized that simply preventing the creation of new debris is no longer sufficient. He warned that active cleanup of the space environment is now crucial to avoid a chain reaction of collision that could render vital orbital regions unusable for future operations. The increasing number of large-scale satellite constellations, such as SpaceX's Starlink and the upcoming Amazon Project Kuiper, is significantly increasing the risk of collision in Earth's orbits. Experts highlighted a 2019 near-miss between a Starlink satellite and an ESA observatory as an example of the escalating danger. With the potential for up to 100,000 satellites and associated debris within the next decade, conference attendees stressed the urgent need for international regulations on spacecraft maneuvering, deorbiting procedures, and launch practices. A high-interest reentry. Originally intended for a Venus landing in 1972, the Soviet Union's Cosmos 482 spacecraft is unexpectedly returning to Earth around May 10th after its launch rocket malfunctioned, leaving it in a decaying Earth orbit for over five decades. Satellite analyst Marco Langbroek anticipates a high-interest reentry because the probe's Venusian atmosphere-resistant design means it will likely survive Earth's reentry and crash land somewhere between 52 degrees north and south latitude, a wide band encompassing much of the populated world. Though an ocean landing is statistically more probable for the roughly 1 meter, 495 kilogram descent craft. The descent module does have a parachute, but the parachute system is unlikely to function after so long in space, posing a minor but not negligible impact risk at its eventual landing site. How many Starlink satellites are too many? In today's Astro Academy segment, we will be discussing Starlink satellites with my friend, sometimes collaborator, dark sky advocate, network engineer, and astrophotographer Mike Lewinsky. Mike is a member of Crestone, Colorado's Dark Sky Committee and has been a presenter at Crestone's Dark Sky Festival. He is a night sky photographer and time-lapse creator whose work has been featured in magazines and as the American Meteor Society's Photo of the Month. You can visit his website at wildernessvagabonds.com. Welcome, Mike. Nice to be talking to you again.
Thank you, Jay. I'm excited to be here.
All right, let's dive right into it. And when did you get started doing night sky photography and time lapses?
So I made my first time-lapse video over 26 years ago in January of 1999. I did not get into night sky photography until April of 2012, mainly due to limits on technology and budget. My first time lapses back in 99 were very tiny, 320 by 240 webcam resolutions. But I was shooting at the Continental Divide up near Nederland and capturing clouds coming over, and I was kind of hooked from the very start. I started up upgraded to a 640 by 480 webcam around 2001 and started making daily time lapses, and was really just waiting for technology to get good enough to do night sky time lapses. But I've been doing almost daily or nightly time lapses of the sky at night since April 2012.
Wow, that's a very precise date. Any significance to that?
No, it's just I have every time lapse that I've ever made in an archive, and I was thinking about this last night. The time lapses from January of 99 were probably the oldest pieces of digital media that I still have possession of over many years of, system upgrades and crashes and lost data and changing platforms.
Wow. For somebody unfamiliar, can you describe what the night sky looked like before the recent surge in satellite constellations like Starlink?
Sure. Of course, I was, doing a lot of naked eye astronomy for years before I got into time lapses. But, just a decade ago, the satellites were rare. I would go on camping trips in southern Utah desert with friends, and one in particular who would bring along a schedule of satellite overpasses, and we would sit there and look for it at the appointed time. It was rare enough that, having a schedule, printed schedule, was necessary. We might see one or two other satellites throughout the course of the night. They would be very faint, and often one of us would spot a satellite, but the other, and try and point it out. It would take a minute to actually find that satellite because it was faint enough and moving slow enough. The exception a decade ago were Iridium satellites, which would flare very brightly for a few seconds, but even those were quite rare. Of course, my camera could see more satellites a decade ago than my naked eye could, but that was also still pretty rare, maybe on the order of in a compiled time lapse video, I might see one or two satellites in a minute. Now we see two things happening today, what we call the trains of recently launched Starlink satellites that travel all together in a line. And those usually are brightest at sunrise or sunset. And then what we see later in the evening is on the horizon nearest the sun, even after the sky is completely dark, we see crisscross patterns of satellites that are in their final orbits. And these will appear almost continuously. And they frequently appear to kind of move across the sky. So you'll see bright flares of lights that are crossing each other just continuously and slowly kind of progressing along the horizon as the I think the appearance of motion is really just that the orbit of the satellites is catching the light of the sun from the other side of the Earth just right.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well. Yeah, and I remember when I first got into kind of naked eye astronomy, and satellite spotting was the first thing, one of the first things that I got into. And I remember specifically seeing the ISS for the first time and being very impressed by that. And at one point, we were actually in our backyard, in our hot tub, and we watched space shuttle docking with the ISS as it passed over our night sky. And so that was pretty thrilling. But yeah, I do see those the crisscross pattern that you talk about of Starlink satellites along the horizon, and it basically goes from the western horizon at dusk through the northern horizon as it goes over the poles. And then I also see that towards dawn in the east.
Yep, that's my experience as well.
What was your initial reaction to first seeing Starlinks?
Well, in the early days, I thought it was pretty cool, especially seeing the Starlink train of recently launched satellites. There's nothing else ever in the night sky that looks like a train of newly launched satellites. They appear to be fairly blue now. And, you know, you see this line of things that are moving all in the same direction, you know, moderately slow. We had a star party here in Crestone on March 1st and noticed that there was a Starlink train over us right at dark. So they're pretty common these days. I'd say I'm capturing 2 to 3 per week in my time lapses. And of course, that tracks with the number of Falcon 9 launches that we're seeing, which are happening almost daily, sometimes more than once a day.
Yeah, and it's often, you know, I run into novices on Facebook or, you know, just people that I'm talking to, and when they see their first Starlink train and they're like, you know, what the heck is that? Is that, you know, the alien invasion? but, you know, once you've seen one and then you know what it is, it becomes a little bit less intimidating. Speaking of the Falcon 9 launches, you notice that you've captured some other phenomena related to the launches?
Yeah, often when the boosters are re-entering the atmosphere, they create a flare of what is red light, and the explanation is basically that they're punching a hole in the Earth's ionosphere as the booster is re-entering and creating, ions that are glowing with energy. And it flares red. I know you've captured this as well. There were two in the last week. And in fact, spaceweather.com had an article about it 2 days ago with a photo of one of the ones that I also happened to capture. And I sometimes do see the rockets launching out of Vandenberg in California, you know, which is quite a ways away. But once they hit the upper atmosphere, I can see the rockets. But I capture these ionosphere holes that they're calling SpaceX Aurora. I capture them, regardless of where the rocket is launched from. The booster happens to re-enter within the field of view, then we would get these, you know, fairly intense red bursts that last for, in the time lapse, they last for a few seconds, but in real time, they would be persisting for 15, 20 minutes.
Okay, so what kind of artifacts or disruptions do Starlink satellites typically create for your long exposure astrophotography images? And how difficult are these to remove during processing?
Yeah, the trails that the satellites create are very noticeable and very disruptive. They make the night sky just appear very unnatural. I'd estimate, you know, it takes a couple minutes to remove all of the brightest satellite trails from a single image. But over a night with two cameras, I'm easily capturing around 5,000 images of the night sky this time of year. It'll be more in the winter and less in the summer, of course. But at 2 minutes per image, to manually remove all the satellites from 5,000 images, that's a week of nonstop editing. And because I produce daily time lapses and still have to sleep and work, it's just not practical to spend 7 days editing still images for each day of time lapse that I make. So I don't even try. I may occasionally have an image of a meteor or northern lights that I want to preserve as a still image, and I'll spend, you know, a few minutes to erase the satellites from that one still image. It is my hope that one of these days there will be an AI tool that will easily differentiate and extract the satellites without removing the meteors, but That's going to be a trick because a lot of the satellites, are bursting for, just a frame or two. And occasionally we get a meteor that lasts for more than one frame. So I'm not sure, that there's not always a really clear, easy way to differentiate, even for me, who's somewhat of an expert at this. Most of the time I can tell, but sometimes it's questionable.
Yeah, I agree. That's been my experience as well, is that it's been more and more difficult to visually separate satellite flares from actual meteors, especially in time lapse where you're doing a long exposure, and the exposure might be 30 seconds. And so, where a meteor might only last 4 or 5 seconds, and a satellite flare might be, 15 seconds. But if you're doing a 30-second exposure, it still appears as kind of the same thing. And one of the things I've kind of noticed is that, meteors tend to have an asymmetrical flare, where it's more of a tadpole shape than satellite flares, which are more I would say symmetrical.
Sure. And that's exactly what you'd expect when you think that a satellite is something that's in a very stable orbit, and it's going to enter the or exit the Earth's shadow and then enter the Earth's shadow at a constant rate of motion, whereas, the meteor is debris burning up. And so it's going to get smaller and produce a smaller trail as it disintegrates.
Yeah, one of my cameras, or I would say instruments, is a meteor capture. It uses some software called CMS. And they've had to adapt that software to try to differentiate between satellite flares and capture meteors, because that software actually accumulates a count and stacks the entire evening's meteor captures. And so that software does a fairly good job of it, but it's kind of an imperfect job at this point. And then also in deep space photography, is that astrophotography, where you're doing kind of live stacking of images. We've seen a huge rise in the amount of images that we have to discard because of the satellites passing through that image of, whatever is a star or a nebula or whatever that we're imaging that particular night. And also I've noticed that, for specific types of observations, like searching for exoplanets, for example, where you're looking for an exoplanet to occlude its particular star, if you have to, you have to exclude some data for a satellite pass, and that can affect your data and basically make your life a little bit more difficult in, for example, exoplanet discovery.
Yep, there's definitely lots of different impacts, and you picked out an important one.
Beyond just visual obstruction, what are the different ways that these satellites are impacting our ability to study the night sky?
Yeah, well, the signal that the satellites are broadcasting can also interfere with radio astronomy, which is a non-visible form of astronomy, capturing radio waves from space. And as you mentioned, it certainly makes it difficult to do image stacking for improved deep sky photography and, as you say, exoplanet discovery. And as mentioned, it makes it harder for us to visually identify meteors of interest in the photos. I found a quote in an article published on cbc.ca last October 3rd, 2024, with a great quote by Meredith Rawls, who is a research scientist at the University of Washington in their astronomy department. And I liked how she put this. She said, doing this is like trying to look through a dirty windshield to do your science. And there's just all this stuff everywhere that's obscuring the view. So
I'll go ahead and put a link to that article in the description for the podcast so that people can read it themselves. And of course, this week was the inaugural launch of the Amazon's Kuiper satellite constellation that's going to basically compete with SpaceX and Starlink. And also the Chinese government is talking about launching their own communications constellations as well. So it's going to be a crowded night sky. So what is the current scientific consensus on the long-term effects of these satellite constellations on ground-based astronomy if the number of satellites continues to increase as planned?
Yeah, the consensus, I think, in the astronomy community is that it's bad. And we know that, you know, astronomers are taking this seriously. The International Astronomical Union has created a Center for the Protection of Dark and Quiet Sky from Satellite Constellation Interference. And quiet, of course, is a reference to the radio noise.
SpaceX has implemented some measures to reduce brightness of their satellites, like the dark sat, you know, quote unquote, and sun visors. How effective have these measures been, in your opinion?
You know, that's a good question, and I wish I had an answer. So far, I think there's very little real improvement, visually speaking, but it's hard to know how much avoided light pollution those measures have, created from an individual satellite. Collectively, the number of satellites just keeps going up. So overall, the situation is really getting worse.
So what do you know about radio frequency interference from Starlink satellites on radio astronomy? Are there protected frequency bands, and are they being affected?
Yeah, that CBC article that I mentioned describes National Science Foundation and National Radio Astronomy Observatory that had an agreement with SpaceX to redirect the satellite beams away from radio telescopes. But on the same day that agreement was announced, another paper was published that shows that the Starlink satellites are unintentionally leaking electromagnetic radiation in low frequencies. So we're back to the dirty windshield analogy. Even when they take a measure, they don't really solve the problem. They might just mitigate parts of it.
And so your profession is as a network, internet network engineer. So the drive for global internet connectivity is understandable. Do you believe that there is a way to balance this goal with the need to protect our night skies for scientific or cultural reasons?
I do. And I would really prefer a combination of terrestrial wireless for rural areas with geostationary satellites, which, of course, we've had for many years. The geostationary satellites are at higher orbits and don't have the same latency profile of the lower satellites that Starlink is launching. And so it does make a difference in terms of how fast the internet is. But, you know, when we're talking about remote places that don't otherwise have internet access, my question is, do I really need, to watch a 4K video while I'm out camped in the Badlands? I think no. In fact, if anything, I'm going out there to kind of get away from technology for a little while. So, I do appreciate that there are people in rural areas who have not had quality internet service. And many of my customers are wireless ISPs who are helping to expand that access and have been for some time. So I'm not saying that there should not be any connectivity in remote places, but actual utilization of the high-speed internet is going to be very low, and I think there's diminishing returns for the harms that are being caused to the night sky with these giant satellite constellations.
Yeah, I have to kind of plead guilty for utilizing Starlink for a while because I live in a remote off-grid situation, and we were the best connectivity that I could get was under 30 megabits per second until Starlink. But I've since discontinued my subscription to Starlink, and so we'll see how that goes. So what's your perspective on the long-term sustainability of such large constellations in terms of orbital debris and things like the potential for collisions?
Yeah, I think that's a really important topic, and I don't think it's sustainable. You know, people talk about a Kessler effect, and that happens when a satellite is hit by debris in orbit and disintegrates and creates more debris that hits more satellites that disintegrate and create more debris until eventually we would end up with so much junk in space created by a cascade effect of functional satellites being turned into debris and turning more satellites into debris that we might be earthbound. We might not be able to safely launch rockets. I think it would be terribly ironic if a project that is like Starlink, that is intended to fund Mars colonization, ultimately prohibits us from even leaving the Earth for generations to come. And you know what I mentioned a few minutes ago about another limitation, and that's another article that I'll ask you to post with this story. It was published in AP News March 10th of this year. It describes how a new study calculates that climate change is going to reduce the amount of available space for satellites in low Earth orbit anywhere from 1/3 to 82% by the end of this century, depending on how much carbon pollution we release. And the explanation for this is that there's a paradoxical effect where the warming of the lower Earth atmosphere causes a cooling of the upper atmosphere. And as the upper atmosphere cools, it becomes less dense. And that reduces drag on all of that debris and all of those satellites, which means that the debris is going to persist longer and not fall back down to Earth and burn away. And finally, there is definitely concern about what comes of the stuff that burns away. It does not completely just turn into nothing. It leaves metal fragments in the atmosphere. And so we are doing really a giant uncontrolled experiment with the Earth's upper atmosphere by injecting substantial amounts of metal. And nobody really knows, you know, if there will be effects with the Earth's magnetosphere, solar winds, or you know, interaction with ozone layer. You know, it's all very much unknown. And probably by the time we get an idea of whether there are any harmful effects, we're going to have a very hard time mitigating that.
Yeah, I just, in fact, in our news segment before you came on, as we talked about a conference in the European Space Agency conference on space debris, and they're basically saying that, you know, it's just something that needs to be acted upon immediately. And a lot of people don't realize that also these Starlinks, they're deorbiting, between, 15 and 30 satellites a week, into the atmosphere. So that's something that is one of those unintentional, consequences. Well, let's get back to dark skies for a moment. What role do you see organizations like the International Dark Sky Association playing in addressing the challenges posed by satellite constellations?
Yeah, I think really at this time, IDA should stay focused on the terrestrial light pollution issues. I hear it discussed, you know, at conferences, and I mean, people are thinking about it, but I think that there is enough important work to be done with terrestrial light pollution that, and there are professional astronomers who are working with, you know, Starlink and other companies to try and ameliorate the harms that I would prefer not to see the International Dark Sky Association really diffuse its focus. I think we have plenty of work to do here on the ground.
Okay, so just as a note to our readers, what can individuals do to support the preservation of dark skies in the light of these challenges?
Yeah, I'd love to see everyone take serious effort to change lighting around their homes, to install shields if lights are unshielded, to install timers if lights are not on timers, to just minimize how much light we allow to escape from our homes. And then, of course, we can work with our city, state, county governments to advance dark sky ordinances so that there's some zoning enforcement of lighting. And this, it will benefit humans, it will benefit wildlife, and it will benefit the whole earth by giving us the, just wonder of truly dark skies where, the difference of standing in a suburb of Denver and looking up, it's, seeing maybe a dozen stars if I'm lucky, versus standing outside my home in Crestone and looking up and seeing thousands of stars, one creates a sense of awe and the other just really doesn't create anything. I feel very disconnected from my place in the universe when I'm in the city. So as individuals, we might not be able to stop satellite constellations, but we can do a lot to improve the night sky that's here around our homes.
So I thank you so much for joining me today, and I'm definitely looking forward to having you back in the future, and we can discuss a lot of different subjects. And so thank you again for joining me today, Mike.
That'd be great. Thank you very much for having me, Jay.
I want to thank all my listeners for checking out this podcast. Please comment, like, and subscribe, and let me know what you'd like to hear more about. You can also check out my Skylapser.com website and Facebook page for live view cameras from the DS9 Observatory, astrophotos, time lapses, and additional content. The intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer wishing you all clear skies.